Welcome once again, nerdlings, to the Nerdist Podcast number 55. Just a few short announcements before you have to go to class. The Nerdist Podcast Live is at SF Sketchfest this weekend in San Francisco, January 28th at Cobb's with our special guest, Mr. Zach Galifianakis, who's in most movies being released presently. Also, the 29th is the music show at SF Sketchfest with myself and Mike Furman and Garfunkel and Oates and David Koechner. And then Monday, the 1st of February, I will be moderating a panel at SF Sketchfest where we're going to show the movie Airplane. And then I'm going to sit down and chat with the Zucker Brothers. The freaking Zucker Brothers. And Robert Hayes. Ted Stryker. So you've got to come to that as well. All the information is at sfsketchfest.com. It'll have tickets, showtimes, a ton of other shows going on there. Super fun. Also, in March, I'm coming to Chicago, March 16th through the 19th. Zanies. You can find information for that at nerdist.com. And now I'm going to shut up so you can enjoy this show, which has Nick Kroll in it. And this is me shutting up now. Okay, thanks, bye.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Are we recording, Matthew?
Yeah, it appears.
This is the best view we've ever had for a podcast.
There you go. The tar pits.
Turpits.
The turpits.
Lacma. No Strings Attached, featuring Natalie Portman and Ashton Kutcher.
Whose joke is it that it's like only L.A. would make a park around a tar pit?
Oh, I don't know, but it sounds really familiar. Yeah. But the more important question is, Jonah, can sex friends stay best friends?
That's not a saying. That's not like a
thing anyone has ever said.
Yeah, and it doesn't even roll off the tongue.
I saw it.
You did?
I did.
And?
I enjoyed it.
Did you really?
I did not think I was going to enjoy it. I am biased because my girlfriend is in it. So that of all.
Well, that's what we were saying. Yeah. What a great film. And
But here's the thing is I also auditioned for it. I wanted to be in it. But it is funny. It's
I heard about the script and everyone was going like, "Holy shit, yeah, this movie is funny." It used to be called
called Fuck Buddies originally, and then it became Friends with Benefits, and then there was like two other movies and a TV show called Friends with Benefits. So they changed it to No Strings Attached.
Mm-hmm.
And Liz Merriweather wrote the script, and the original script was one of the funniest scripts I've read, bar none. And the movie's funny. It's like it's a romantic comedy.
Is it a romp?
It's a romp.
It's a rom-com romp?
Rom-com romp, sex romp.
But there are some laugh-out-loud lines in it, and everybody's good in it.
Well, that voice you're hearing is Nick Kroll! whose girlfriend is in No Strings Attached.
No Stings Attached. It's a movie.
Oh,
all
God,
about
for bees,
too? It's about how the police broke up.
yeah, exactly.
It's all from the point of view of Andy Summers.
Oh, God. the third guy? Man, I saw them at Bonnaroo. And you'd never seen three people stand farther apart on a stage.
And you know what's so funny about that to me is like, guys, you're making $1.2 million a show.
Sting is making $1.2 million.
You don't think? I thought they were all but getting. Well, I thought it was like, Favorite Nations.
They were doing.
It's all in loot.
They were doing their shows, and like Sting kept on going, like, it's like all the money we're making is going to these charities, and like it's like that's fine for Sting, the one who's continued to make millions of dollars. But, you know.
I feel like those other dudes got some cash from selling those albums. Mm. But they looked weird. It's weird on stage because you look at, there's the Andy Summers, who could be Mark Summers for all I know.
Right. Andy Summers did host Family Double Dare.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then Stu Copeland,
who now looks like a dad. I mean, older than a dad. He looks like a young granddad.
Wow. Yeah,
who's like taking his like? I'm still active.
Mm-hmm.
I jog. I play racquetball.
I take my iron supplements.
Yeah, exactly.
He looks like a college professor.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Like so a slightly sleazy college professor
that sleeps with at least who's one like girl every semester.
Who's like, Allison, come over tomorrow and we'll do grass and maybe I'll show you some of the poetry I did with Vonnegut.
That's like that sounds like Donald Sutherland's character in Animal.
Exactly. Oh, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly. What he is.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's Sting, who is perfect, like genetically, who looks better than any of us ever will.
Tantric sex, man.
Tantric sex.
Is it? Is he a vegetarian, or did he slaughter infants and consume their blood?
I think so. I think he. But my feeling is like if Hitler had had Sting, then people would have been like, okay, yeah. I get it.
Oh no! Now I see what you're talking about.
Hitler. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, literally, because he is physically at. He's got to be pushing 60.
Yeah,
like perfect and in amazing shape.
He always, I was just, I don't know why, the other day I was driving around and maybe I was listening to Sirius Radio in the car and I mean Sirius XM, not like, I'm listening to Sirius Radio.
Really, this Sirius guy.
And you know, like the Police Solo Only came on and I was just thinking about Sting's evolution as a performer. And like those early Police albums, he was this like crazy, like wild haired punk,
yeah,
mm-hmm. You know, like who dressed like the fucking Road Warrior.
Yeah, the Sting box or the Police box set, like the earlier stuff is just straight up punk, like really thrashy, awesome stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then
there's like this, then there's like the Studio 60 lewd playing. Do you know what I mean? Did you guys watch that episode where it's just like, and now Sting, and it's just like,
yeah. Studio fucking 60. Yeah.
Dude, I didn't know the bass could have, you know, that many strings. He has like a 15 string bass.
By the way, I just saw an episode of 30 Rock with. It's the one, I don't know if it's from this season or the end of last season where Jenna becomes a producer on the mm-hmm. show. Yeah. And at the end of the episode when they're doing the credits, the last two writers on the credits in the fake episode are Ricky and Ronnie.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. It's like their one little joke. It was like I just caught
That's
it at
hilarious.
The end.
Yeah, it was so genius.
Yeah, it's amazing.
They're good at that.
Yeah.
Just putting in
God
a little,
damn
just
it.
A
little something.
So genius. Yeah. I mean that, you know, that show started to because I like Matt Perry
mm-hmm.
and that and Studio 60 made me kind of have like not like Matt Perry a little bit because his and it wasn't his fault at all like he's a totally fine dude and he's hilarious but because his character was supposed to be this super edgy comedy writer and the stuff that he would kind of arrogantly stand over like well guys we did it was the worst sketch
yeah.
writing yeah. ever
that was the problem.
That's what's so great about 30 Rock, though, is they really just keep on making shots at it. Whereas there was that one thing where it's Judah Friedlander's arguing with Liz Lemon, or you know, Tina Fey's character, about like it's like no, I need four bears, and she's like, are you really trying to bring logic into the robot bear sketch? And just like I love that's what I love about the show. It's like it really it's like you know when guys in comedy are just like it's like no, it has to be this way.
Yeah.
It's like
yeah.
the fart machine has to fucking be like
and, that's
like,
OCD shit. That's all yeah. that's all obsessive compulsive exactly. Comic shit. And by the way, mm-hmm. I know Studio 60 was not a documentary, so I don't blame Matt Perry. I blame Aaron Sorkin.
There you go.
But I
your brother's dying in Afghanistan.
I did see The Social Network a couple nights ago, and it's fucking
good.
Phenomenal.
Well, that's the thing is like stick to what you know, which is
youth culture.
Yeah, I will say though, I don't think
I don't know what I'm saying.
I don't think anyone going to college in the early 2000s would have gotten the Towering Inferno reference. Like there were a couple of those where I was like, that's an Aaron Sorkin gem.
But yeah. the Karate Kid reference was fantastic.
I didn't even think they would have gotten the Karate Kid reference.
The Karate Kid reference, like when they're just like, we should go, like one of the twins retires.
Oh right, right.
It's like, come on, well, we might as well put on some skeleton.
Yeah.
Which I still don't even think then. I don't think a college kid.
I got it.
Yeah, but you're not a college kid.
I was at that exact time. I was at BU when he was at
when he was tearing shit up over on Face Mash.
Did you know about the buzz?
I knew about the Face.
Was there heat?
Did you hear those blips and beeps when he was walking around campus?
Like, were you friends with the girl? Were you one of the guys actually at that table?
Did you blow him in the bathroom?
Twice.
Did you and your girlfriend go in and blow him in Wardo?
I took a shot in the mouth because those are the times.
Think that like I've been thinking about this like those guys. Watching those movies, like a guy who just watches those movies and takes it as historical fact.
Right.
Like, and then Zuckerberg went to that one table and she was angry with him. And then he came up with the dating part of it.
Yeah, because you know, at that table, there was that black guy right there, and he was not happy. He wanted to make sure that there was no
problem. The black guy got angry, so he left, and then he decided he was going to do the whole company.
Right.
And then, so that's when he decided to go beyond the Ivy League. And
how my ex-wife tracked me down, and I got to pay alimony.
So
fuck that guy.
Yeah. Like, or Ray, where it's just like, and then She found him doing heroin one too many times. She left, and then he had to go out on his own.
No, you think you might be oversimplifying this at all?
I saw it in a movie.
I thought they did a really nice job. I think Jesse Eisenberg was great. I mean, like everyone in the movie was
everyone's really good.
I was, you know, I was skeptical of Andrew Garfield at first because I'm like, Spider-Man, huh? We'll see about it. I even said to Janet when the movie started, like, I don't think I see this guy Spider-Man. He was so fucking great in Social Network. Really, he played that character so well.
Yeah.
I'm kind of excited to see him as Spider-Man.
Well, he plays Butthurt very well. It's like, we were friends.
Yeah, he totally was.
So sad.
He is but they play that very smartly where you're like, oh yeah, Andrew Garfield's I'm sure a real loser on campus. Yeah. And then he teetered right sort of in between there nicely of like he was getting socially accepted and the other kid wasn't. Like it was well done.
Yeah.
I thought he did an excellent job of kind of playing the likable doormat. Which is basically what he was. The guy's like, no, I just need all this. Okay.
All right. Yeah, just like the rich kid in any 80s movie.
He wants to be friends. Like it's that weird thing where the rich kind of good-looking kid wants to be friends with the super smart kids.
Yeah.
Because he's had business-minded. Yeah. Am I going into this too much? Maybe
no,
I'm thinking
no,
of this
no.
too much.
But it is, by the way, and the music won the Golden Globe, that Trent Reznor and the other dude. Poor
Trent
other guy.
The other dude.
But it is truly like when you hear the intro music or when like at award ceremony, it's like they created an iconic sound, whatever that like that weird simple three chord piano thing.
Yeah.
Totally works.
Yeah. That was always so funny though, like in the Golden Globes when they would announce, you know, the movie winning something, and they would just be
they were
going
great.
Up, you know.
It's totally worked.
I think Trent Reznor should score everything.
Let's do it.
Let's have him score the Oscars.
I think so.
Score the Golden. For the Oscars.
But only like Trent Reznor for like the style he had during like Head Like a Hole era.
And the Emmy for best song goes to Trent Reznor, lyrics by Bruce Valanche.
Head like a hole, black as my hole. Thanks, Myra.
Yeah.
Nick, now, I guess I probably... I've known you about like five years now, maybe, roughly.
Yeah, although we met... I remember meeting you at McManus, like, probably,
oh my God.
Like, 7-8 years ago.
Oh, my... Those were the old drinking days. Yeah, when McManus used to be right next to the UCB on 19th and 7th.
Yeah, I think Sean Conroy, you were buddies with him, and I was like... I was like just beginning comedy. I was like, "Yeah, I'm gonna sit in back." Like, you know, it was like there was the front of the bar where you sort of like meandered, and then there was like the back where
tables. And
it's funny how people will sort of find their perceived social place.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, I guess we should sit back over there.
Maybe we don't deserve to be up in the back yet. And then you sort of like make your like a dog like trying to sit in a new room. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Is this cool? This is not a big deal.
That's fine. Then you have your friends that you're still kind of starting with, and then like, you know, one kid goes and sits with me. He's like, dude, you fucking sat in the back.
Yeah, exactly. You
know? I talked to Horatio Sands. Yeah. I talked to fat drunk Chris Hardwick. FDH.
But I'm thinking, but I think that's what it was. But that was probably six, seven.
That was actually like 10 years ago.
Was it? Well, yeah, no, was... it was probably where you were still, because you were like, I was still drinking.
I was still, yeah, because that's been off the table for about 8 years now. So
well, then it was probably about 8 years, because I came to New York. No, that would make sense. 8-9 years ago.
Because Conroy was doing the Hump Day show. The Hump Night show. Hump Day. The Hump Night show at UCB with Eddie Pepitone.
Yes.
And I did that show.
Uh-huh.
Your character stuff, which your stand-up to me is as good as your character stuff, which is maddening because I'm sucky at character stuff, and I always abandon it because I was just – I mean I'm the guy who's really obvious about everything, like, oh, they know it's me, and then I'll just take the wig off.
Yeah.
Ah, they know it's me. Yeah. I'm just going to talk.
No.
It's true.
Is that what you're supposed to say?
No. You're
Yeah, my musical comedy is really great, though. No, I'm trying to think. Yeah, it was probably. I'm wondering what the first show we did was. I mean, I think I just saw. I saw you. We met there, but then I feel like I didn't see you for probably a couple of years until
you didn't. You were East Coast for a long time.
I was New York, and then I moved out here about a little over 3 years ago.
What are some of the differences between New York and LA?
I hear there are a lot. Are they like men and women?
You know what I honestly do miss more than anything about New York, as and I've just accepted that I will call myself an artist, is that I really do miss the New York for the proximity of like social observation. Mm-hmm. That I think that is really what I miss most about New York, more than LA. I miss the subway. Like I miss like gathering information on the subway.
We're a very isolated culture in Los Angeles.
It's really crazy. Isolating. And the other time I get it is like it's really transit. Like at the airport is like a big time for me to sort of like see what people are reading, what they're dressed like, how they talk to their family, all those things that like we're all pretty in LA. It's like we are truly isolated from one another. We get in our cars and we drive from one place to the next. And I do miss that about New York, because I feel like I gather a lot of information about people that way.
And now, so your background was acting, and then you went into comedy.
No, I did improv in college.
That's what it was.
Yes.
In DC, right?
In DC, I went to Georgetown, and Mike Birbiglia cast me in a sketch show my freshman year. I'd never done comedy before. I did a Funniest Act on Campus, which I bombed horrifically.
What did you do?
My bit was that I was going to get on stage and say how, like, oh, I thought I'd be so nervous, but I'm really relaxed. And then I was going to have a water balloon and a pin and pop the water balloon and then piss my pants and be like, oh, you know, like, ha, ha, ha. But I got super drunk and baked beforehand, thinking that would make me less nervous, because I was actually quite nervous. And then I forgot the water balloon and pin, and I got to the venue and was rummaging around backstage and found, like, a plastic bag with a, you know, like a sandwich bag, and took the sandwich out and filled it with water. It was still like wheat bits floating around inside. And grabbed a pen and got on stage. Like, God, I thought I was going to be so nervous, but I'm really relaxed. And then just like jamming the pen into the water bag. It just looked like I was like furiously masturbating. So it didn't work at all. But Biggs saw the tape of it. By the way, and the tape, you know, in like college, the tape was thrown away, or was because some kid who did the act also made some like really racist jokes. And so, you know, in college, everyone's like super sensitive.
So sensitive.
So it was like the tape needs to disappear because like Brian McFadden made like a black joke.
We all need to go home and think about what we've done.
Exactly.
Yeah, when you start doing colleges, you think, oh, they're college kids. They like South Park. You can just say whatever you want. They'll fucking love it.
No.
And they are the tightest.
Yeah.
Most.
Yeah. If you could just refrain from any racial humor and any, like, that was the note you get sometimes before.
I got an ooh once because I said like, oh, so you know, I was hanging out with this Mexican friend of mine. Everyone was like, ooh. I'm like, wait, that's his heritage.
You can't say that.
You can't say the word Mexican.
Not his fault.
What?
That is a Puerto Rican. That in a 30 Rock, there is a joke that's like Puerto. They say Puerto Rican, and they're like, you can't say
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
he's just like, no, that's what
it is.
But yeah, so Biggs then cast me in a group, or I went and auditioned for the sketch show. The other people didn't want me in it, but Birbiglia was like, this guy's got, you know, this guy's funny. And so I did the sketch show, which I'd never done before, and it blew my, it, like, I don't know about you guys, but for me it was like, I never knew growing up that you could like be a comedian. Mm-hmm. Like I loved comedy. I always wanted to think quietly to be one, but I didn't think people actually like did it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I didn't know how like Mike Myers became Mike Myers. All I knew is I loved Wayne's World, but I didn't know like, oh, you can do this.
Right.
And then we saw UCB came down to at the end of the year to George GW to do an improv like festival. And their show is about to come out, you know, this Comedy Central show.
Oh, so it was actually Matt.
It was Matt, Ian, Amy, and Matt.
Okay.
And they were, like, I remember watching Little Donnie. Do you guys remember the Little Donnie sketch?
Donnie movie.
Yeah, and it was like it was Matt Besser was like a six-year-old with a huge cock.
Yeah, Little Donnie's disease.
Yeah, and he just like, and I can visualize it because we were about to go on stage and we were behind the screen. And so I remember seeing the screen, you know, like the projection of the screen in front of, you know, in front of me, but behind the stage of like his donger, like dangling on a swing. And then I watched them do an ass cat, like their, you know, their improv format. And like my mind exploded.
Yeah.
And so from there, we kept doing workshops throughout college. My senior year, John Mulaney was, I cast Mulaney in the improv troupe, and we became buddies through that. And then, and there are other guys who did the, you know, my friend Allison Becker, who's super funny, is recurring on Parks and Rec and VH1, all this stuff. And Brian Donovan, who's like, you know, ran a NPR show and does a bunch of VH1 stuff. And a bunch of us ended up performing out of that, you know. And then did stand-up and moved to New York and then started doing stand-up there.
What was the show you had with Mulaney? I can't remember.
It was called Oh Hello.
Oh Hello, and you had the sweaters on.
Yeah, so yeah.
That was one of the first, when I was out there for about 3 months in 2005-06, that was one of the first shows I saw.
Oh, really?
At Rafifi, yeah.
Oh, man. That was fun. And I did it with, well, I did. Did you ever do our show? Did you ever do
Yeah, I did the Rafifi show.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I did it.
We did Mulaney. It was Mulaney and I, and then before that was Jesse Klein and I.
Yeah, I think I did it. I feel like I did it a couple times.
Yeah.
In that space that, is it still there?
No, it became a vintage clothing store.
It did, because for the longest time they were always saying, like, Rafifi's going to close, but then it stayed open for another few years.
And then it closed. But that was like,
it was a fun space.
It was
the
great.
Bar to the other side, then they closed.
It was a bar up front and then in back, and it was the other show was, not the other show. The main show there was Invite Them Up. Yeah. That was like,
Eugene and Bobby.
Yeah, it was Eugene, Merman, and Bobby Tisdale's show. And I remember doing that show for the first time and being so, so nervous.
Yeah.
And then doing it and it being, I'm like, I'm not ready. I wasn't ready. And I wasn't. Like, I
did
took
you
a year
stand
off.
Up? Did you do stand-up?
I did stand-up. And I was still figuring it out. I mean, for, you know, I still like feel like we're all still figuring it out.
I don't know if that ends until you
die.
Until you die. Until you die. Or until you get to a point where you just kind of click on autopilot. You're like, I'm just going to do these same jokes, same 45 minutes for years and years and years. Then I think maybe you don't learn anymore.
Yeah. But I think it was that you're in that period where you're trying to figure out what your jokes are, and then you're either feeling like, I can't do the same jokes because so-and-so's seen that joke before, before you realize that you need to do the same jokes.
Yeah.
Or you're like, I've done these jokes for so long or whatever, you know, whatever it is.
That's so funny. I feel like so many young comics make this decision when they start doing comedy where they do, I did it too, where I was like, I'm going to do different material every week. Because you just, number one, you don't understand, A, how hard that is.
Yeah.
I think I just said number one and then A. So one A.
A1.
Subset, so one B is that there is an actual craft, not just in coming up with bits, but then also like whittling them down and connecting them to other things and building a point of view. Like that is a whole separate skill set.
Yeah, I think it is like for me, what I tell anybody who's like trying to do it, and a lot of my like improv friends or sketch guys who come more out of the UCB than out of the stand-up world who are like, I'm trying to do it, I'm trying to, you know, like, and I think if you want to do stand-up, you have to sort of be like, the beauty is in the edit and the polish.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have the true art of it, if you're going to find, like, joy in it, is, I think, in that process of, like, whittling things down, connecting pieces, and just breaking things down to the bare essence of like what they are.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it can be maddening, I think.
Is it easier because you come from such a, like, you do such great character stuff, when you're writing your stand-up, are you writing for the character of Nick Kroll or are you just writing jokes?
Well, that's the problem, I think, for me, is that I found the characters always to be easier because for a long time, because it was always like, oh, I know this character's point of view.
Exactly.
Or I can pretend to, I'm going to, you know, boil this person down to this, these stereotypical ideas that I have of this kind of person. And for myself, I'm like, I don't know what I think about everything or I'm more complicated, or I'm not like a type. And so that has been the struggle, I think, is to like find your voice or find one's voice.
I think, yeah, because Kyle Ryan from the AV Club just emailed me and he said they were doing a piece with you.
Oh, yeah.
For AV Club, because he asked me, he had heard me say, maybe on this podcast or something, about, he said, did you say that Patton said it took 7 years?
Yes, they asked me that. They just asked me that question.
Well, I don't know if it was Patton specifically who said that. I know you know, I know Posehn said it was, it, you know, like, six to ten.
Yeah. Yeah. In Comedians of Comedy, he said 10 years before he started writing jokes that he felt were, like, worth him. like that felt like it was actually him.
Right.
It took 10 years, you know.
It does take a while.
I remember hearing an interview with Leno, and I don't remember what the number was, but he's like, not until after, like, 1,000 sets did I feel like I could start really doing stand-up.
Yeah, I early on, I guess maybe like 96 or so, I bombed really. I would do stand up.
Largo?
No, that is a legendary bombing. But this was a bombing outside the comedy community of Los Angeles. But somehow I became pals with Louis Anderson, and I met him at a party or something, and we didn't fuck or anything, and so he.
Oh, feud.
Sorry. and so he said, "Hey, I'm doing some shows at the Irvine Improv. Why don't you come out and you can do a feature set?" And at this point, I was calling myself a comic, but really hadn't done a lot of shows. Mm-hmm. And so I had a great set the first night. I'm like, "Oh, comedy's easy." Of course, the second night, I invite my girlfriend and my parents out, and just bombed really horribly. And so backstage, of course, I'm beating myself up, and in between, my mom going like, "I just don't know why you had to swear so much." I'm right. Like, now is not the time.
Right, right.
And Louis said, "You know, go out and do 100 shows and then see where you are, because you just can't. When people say, how do I become a comic?' You're like, you have to perform
just do it.
As much as you possibly can, and then you can take stock after you've done it for a long time."
Yeah, I think about it as like, I'm like, you have to get on stage, grab the microphone out of the mic stand, and put it to the side.
That's a big, yeah.
And like, once you stop thinking about, once you do that without thinking about it, then you're beginning to like be a comic.
Yeah.
Unless your thing is you hold on to the mic in the mic stand or whatever it is. Like, for me, for years, and even still, sometimes I'll be like, I'll be holding a microphone and being like, I'll be doing my set and be like, I'm holding a microphone. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
you're so aware of it.
You're so aware of like how you're doing things that it's just muscle memory, I think.
I remember a long time ago, his Jeselnik, his style in the beginning was just like, you know, holding the mic.
Anthony
like,
Jeselnik?
Yeah, Anthony Jeselnik was like holding the mic, kind of like, you know, it was like, you know, Rollins or something like that, just like, you know, hand on top, hand on the, you know, stem. And he got a note after a showcase saying, it's like, oh, he's nervous. He's holding on to the mic stand.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and so like he's like, I'm not nervous. It's just like, it's a badass way of holding the mic stand.
Right.
And then so he stopped doing it, and the guy's like, yeah, there you go.
There you go. Now you're ready.
Yeah, I love.
I'm a parasite. Now you're ready.
Now I can take credit.
Yeah, but it is that thing. I was listening. This is sort of a separate thing, but like, there's a Fresh Air interview with Jay-Z, which is awesome. It's about his Decoded, his book, and it was Terry Gross and Jay-Z. Is this weird to be doing, talking about another radio podcast?
No, yeah. We don't, what are you talking about? There's no other broadcast outside of this one.
And it's fascinating. And she's like, you know, little Terry Gross, who I haven't met her, but I've been told is like...
Does she have little Terry Gross disease?
She's like, I supposedly like... under 5 feet tall, like a tiny woman who is the cool, like to me, such an amazing like consumer of media, like really neat. And she had Jay-Z on and she was like, what's the deal with like rappers grabbing their crotches on stage? Like, I have to ask you this. And he's like, his theory was most of the time rappers become musicians, like their music leads. So, like, whereas a rock group, they go out and they perform, and then if they're really good, they break, and then they're huge, and they've been performing for years. Rappers, he's like, the music leads. So they've been sitting alone, making their music, and all of a sudden they can have, like, a number one hit, and then they start performing. Mm-hmm. And they'll, like, go out and do, like, a summer jam in front of, like, 50,000 people, having never really performed before. And when you're nervous, it feels like you're naked, and so when you're naked, you want to cover your material.
I feel like I saw him say that on the Charlie Rose. Did you see the Charlie Rose?
No, but I'm sure that's his.
God damn it, that was so.
Was it great. Interesting?
Yeah, until Charlie Rose said, "Tell me about Tupac."
And
Jay-Z laughed, and he was like, and I think Jay-Z's response was, "The funny thing about white people," and then Charlie goes, "Yeah, careful. And then he said, "The funny thing about white people is that, you know, it's Tupac, not Tupac."
Right.
So, but other than that, the interview was...
It's smart. It's super interesting to listen to him. But it's funny to me because Jay-Z's voice, like, quivers. And he's like, you know, Terry, it's a little like this. And he's so smart and so interesting, but he doesn't have a strong speaking voice.
Because he's rapping all the time, right? That's right. What rappers do. They rap. They rap for their breakfast.
That's for them raps.
Yep.
I don't know what brought us to
that. What rhymes with pancakes? I want some pancakes. Like, you can't order it unless you can rhyme it with something.
What was that? On stage posture.
Oh, posturing. So just the idea of like grabbing a mic. And I understand that. Like I was always jealous of those guys who got on stage, grabbed a mic or whatever they did, and then stood in that position because it seemed to me like they were settled into whatever it was that they did, you know? And I could always... You know, and I still like with the characters. It's always like, okay, this is how Fabrice would hold the mic, or and I didn't know until recently with like if I did Bobby Bottle Service on stage, like how he would, and I like finally like thought about it. I mean, sometimes it's so weird with comedy where you're just like, oh, just take 5 minutes and think about it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like
think about the set, just a little
just
bit
like,
before the set.
Actually, think about it. Like actually, sit down and think about it. And you'll come up with something.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It's weird how you can outthink yourself into just not thinking about things.
Yeah.
Like, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
Just take a breath.
Yeah.
Calm down. You're not
going to
die.
You know that joke you do that every night that doesn't really work?
Think about it. Really process. Maybe why?
Yeah.
Why doesn't it work?
Yeah. And maybe try to fix it.
Would you rather do... You know, if you're doing, you know, if you're doing a set on a talk show or whatever, would you rather do your stand-up or would you rather do your character?
I really love doing both. Like, I've started to, you know, I really like doing stand-up. Like, I enjoy that. I like not having to hide behind the characters, which it feels like sometimes. That said, I also love doing the characters. There's a lot of stuff that I feel comfortable saying as a character that I don't feel comfortable saying as myself. Things I can get away with.
Yeah.
And then
I feel especially with Fabrice.
Yeah. He's vicious and dirty, and there's stuff that I would just never say. I would never want anyone to think coming out of my mouth.
Yeah,
even though it's, you know, he's kind of, I guess it's like my the suicide bomber Jeff Dunham's.
Oh God.
Ahmed. No, he's an actual comedian. what is it? Ahmed the, isn't it?
Jihad. Jerry the Jihad. No.
I don't know what it is.
Jerry the Jihad.
Jerry the Jihad.
It's some form of taking someone's culture and then belittling it in a way.
I made a little thing online just for kicks that I thought was going to take off but never did. But it was a picture of Jeff Dunham and like the old man. And like I did a parody of the Fresh Prince DJ Jazzy Jeff thing, and it was I'm the racist, he's the dummy. And I really thought it was going to really take funny. Off, and it never did. I even got the same typeface as the, you know, the little.
Were you able to? You had to throw the puppet out the door.
Yes. Yeah.
Jonah, it's never the ones that you engineer to become hits online. It's always the ones where you're like. Oh, yeah, I just took a shit in the shape of James Gandolfini. I better take a picture of that. And then, like, you know, that's 5 million views later.
When I did a big drill and then a little baby drill with a bow on it, drill baby drill, that did not take off as much as I thought it would.
Did not work as well. No.
Yeah, we – but I do feel like it was – but I do enjoy – really – in the special that I bothered you about coming on your show to promote.
Well, I wanted you to come on the show anyway, so it just worked out that you had a good thing to promote.
We have been talking about
doing
this.
By the way, if I were a comedy fan, Nick Kroll, and I, say, wanted to spend an hour watching perform on television, when would I
you
be
You might
able to
be
do
able
that?
To do that. I have a 1-hour special for Comedy Central called Nick Kroll, Thank You, Very Cool, coming
Sorry, it's weird. I've read it multiple times online, but hearing it aloud makes me laugh.
Oh, good. I'm glad. That it's January 29th, Saturday at 10 p.m. It's the end of like their day of like stand-up showdown stuff. And it's a mix of the characters and the stand-up. It's all integrated into one special.
So did you, when you were performing, did you come out as Nick Kroll and then leave stage? And how did you shoot it?
Well, the idea of the whole thing is that it's sort of like a one-man Muppet show.
Okay.
So it's like Fabrice is the craft service coordinator at the event. Bobby Bottle Service is the security guard at the event. Oh Hello, me and John Mulaney are like in the crowd, like Statler and Waldorf.
That's a great idea for an hour special. I never see anyone
Thank
do
you.
That.
Thank yeah. you. And then Chupacabra is the announcer for the whole evening.
Hola, baby.
So Fabrice and Bobby performed live, and then stand up, and we, I think I came out as Bobby. And then we showed some videos and then there's a bunch of short film stuff throughout, you know, of the rest of the, you know, the stuff that wasn't live on stage. So we showed a bunch of that to the audience. And while that was going on, I changed into Nick. And then I did my whole Nick set and then showed some more videos and then came back as Fabrice.
Now, I'm not even patronizing you. I actually want to see this.
Oh, I'm glad.
I actually want to see your special. It sounds really great.
I like it when in comics, you know, a lot of comics we know just do the half hour special or the hour special, and it's really straightforward. But I always like it when like somebody, you know, takes the time to make it actually special and make it look like nothing else, none of the other specials. Like when Dimitri did his first special, he like segmented it into a very progressive thing where he did the stand-up and then he brought out the easel and then he did the guitar stuff. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, it's a...
Yeah, I think I just, you know, it was truly an attempt to just what's the most effective way of doing what I think people like the most. Yeah. And it was partly out of it being like, I do stand up, I enjoy it, I feel like people like it, but I think people really are going to want this other stuff, and I wanted to do it. And so it was sort of figuring out, and I brainstormed with a few friends and sort of was like, how can we do this, and came to this sort of like, you know, this hybrid thing. And I watched people's specials, and like Patton's last special that Jason Wolliner directed, there were sketches and stuff throughout, and Zach's Purple Onion special. I really liked, it starts with him and Joe Wagner driving up the coast. And there was something about like, oh, I love the idea of the process of it. Like that Zach like drove up from LA to San Francisco. And then it's this very gritty feel of like what that show is actually like. And I liked that element of like seeing process, I guess, you know. And so then it was figuring out how to integrate all these people. And, you know, a lot of those characters are sort of around showbiz in some form or other, and so it wasn't insane to get them, you know.
We could ask Zach about that when he does the Nerdist podcast live at SF Sketchfest on January 28th.
Yeah.
You guys want to plug anything?
Yeah.
Same thing.
Okay.
Same thing.
You guys are doing it up there next week?
Yeah, we're doing it. Yeah, it's Friday, so it's not going to interfere with
your
show.
So it's not going
to
be...
So you could watch, you could come to our show. Actually, I think our show sold out, but...
There's still tickets available for The Meltdown with me and Kumail Nanjiani Sunday.
That's perfect.
So great.
Perfect.
So it's a perfect sandwich.
Yep.
Start with a Nerdist live podcast,
yep.
Then watch Nick Kroll's Thank You Very Cool special.
Which I think, by the way, will provide, because all the elements you have, will be perfect sandwich meat.
Yes.
Because there are a lot of different... It's more like a submarine sandwich.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of different stuff in there.
It's like a club.
It's a club sandwich.
It's a club sandwich.
It's a club sandwich.
With like a veganaise.
Okay. What's the difference, really, when it comes down to it? What's the difference?
Eggs.
No, I know, technically.
Oh, okay. Okay, all right. Good. But it is eggs. Like, all joking aside, it's eggs.
I'm just saying, if I were... You know,
I know. I totally see
But if
it.
I didn't know, like,
right,
what
no,
would it be?
Of course. That's what I'm saying. It would just mainly be eggs.
No, but like, other than that.
Right.
Other than that part of it, that it came out of an animal...
Right.
So Arizo and vegan A's, just mix it together.
That's all it is.
Mm.
By pretty good, by the way.
Yeah.
I don't miss mayonnaise when I got some vegan A's. Tonight's show is sponsored by vegan A's.
You can still make your own wasabi vegan A's too. I do that sometimes.
Really?
Yeah.
Look at you.
What? Mix a little wasabi in there?
Yeah, you know, you can get wasabi mayonnaise, which is great.
Really?
Or like mahi patties, or if you're making a grilled like ahi burger.
That sounds like Hawaiian shit to me.
Yeah, man.
Maybe it is, Chris.
Mahi
What's
patties.
Wrong with that?
We don't even use that term over here in the contiguous states. You're not a contiguous statesman.
No, I'm a freak.
This is like what people would do. Like, if we about, you know, if there's somebody we were able to take away all race and religion and, you know, and cultures, and that's those are the kind of things we'd be isolating ourselves. Like, Those are the Mahi Patty assholes.
Well, it's Reginald Hayworth, a comic from England. Is this guy who grew up in Atlanta, and like he has this whole thing where like a bit where he comes back home from England, and his like friends are asking him, like, "Oh, is it racist out there? A lot of racists?" He's all, "No, they actually have something else called classist." Like, yeah. Classism. They're like, "What's that?" He's all, "That's a way for people to figure out how to hate someone that looks exactly like them."
That's funny. There's an old. I was at a museum and saw a Van Gogh painting. And it's called the Potato Eaters, and I thought it was just such a funny. It was like that was how they would call like poor people in like in Belgium who only could afford to eat potatoes.
Oh, also, it's kind of racist.
Yeah. And it's like fucking potato eaters.
Yeah, someone else had the idea that like the reason that people like really like hate like the you know Latino influx in the country is just that like every other culture has had their you know their coming to America phase like you know the Irish came everyone hated the Irish the Polish came everyone hated the Polish but the thing is like but then they stopped coming necessarily in huge droves. The thing is that's never stopped like the Latino invade like you know like people coming
is this where we start to get. Like into the teabagger movement, or
that's what we're all here for, right? I mean, listen. Yeah. I mean, since the laughing has stopped, I think it's important that we recognize what's really happening here.
Drop a truth bomb on y'all.
No, but it is true. There's no end to it.
Hey, listen.
No, I think that's
I have nothing against Latino culture. My Italian great grandparents came here and plopped out 11 kids.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, take that, Mexicans.
Yeah.
You just got the Italian challenge dropped on you. 11.
Is this in, like, Tennessee?
No. My mother's family is Italian, and they came over and landed in New York and then went to Jersey. And
just spread out.
11 Italian. I have so many fucking cousins that I've never seen in my life.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. And it's you know it's what it, basically the Italians when they came over just turned into this crazy pyramid scheme of humans, and they have 11, and pretty soon it's 100 million Italianos.
My whole family is the half side is Italian and then Spanish, and if you look at our family tree, right at the generation of before my parents or their parents, huge numbers, and then. Two people, and then two people, and it just dropped off.
Right,
we're killing ourselves.
Well, yeah. I don't know if it's. I mean, they tie you know birth rates to, I mean, to get it back to class and stuff like that. And I don't
Please
know if
do.
It was.
It's a comedy podcast.
Okay, but it is. But you know, a question of like one, who knows how many will survive. Two, we need kids to work, people to work. You know what I mean? And I wonder if it slowly goes down the longer
it's
people are in
the country.
It's good for concerts.
Also, I think if you're working a job every day that's crushing your soul, you want to go home and fuck somebody
unprotected.
Yeah. Because really, those are the best orgasms. Am I right, guys?
What's the point if you have anything? Yeah. You know?
That reminds me of the first state sketch I ever saw was Michael Ian Black, and it was something like. After a long day of... It was like he was doing one of those two-camera commercials.
Oh, yeah. Right.
After a long day of work, I like to go home and have some unprotected sex.
Really?
Yeah,
unprotected sex.
Unprotected sex. He says something, and those orgasms feel great.
There's... And he's got kids.
Yeah, Michael Ian Black does have kids, so he literally... He lived as he preached.
It's so funny to think of Michael Ian Black having kids.
Yeah.
I've never seen his kids
or his wife.
Hmm.
They're real, right?
This Supposedly. Just a, yeah. I've seen pictures that look photoshopped.
Shopped.
Yeah.
Pictures or it's not real.
Fake.
So what are you doing any other shows in Los Angeles this week before?
I'm this won't air. This isn't streaming, right?
This is not streaming. This is going to drop, as it were, on Monday.
Great. Well, as of Monday, I will have just gone here. I love when you do podcasts because you're like time tenses.
You're trying to guess the time. Yeah.
So on Friday, I had went to the Gallery 1988 and did a Bobby Bottle service
was
in store.
I will had gone to.
It, yeah. It was great. It yeah, willed be great.
Yeah, the Bobby Bottle service thing at the Gallery 1988 show was pretty spectacular.
Oh, the vodka.
Yeah.
How amazing is that that thing?
Yeah, the show was.
The Gallery 1988. If you live in LA, go check out. It's for a couple more days. It's probably ending pretty soon. Actually,
it ends on the day of your show.
It ends on
the January 29th. Yeah,
that's right. So, I'm going to be in New York to do. Bobby is going to be in New York on the 26th at the Hundreds store downtown. doing a signing some limited edition screen prints and meet and greet, and then Vegas on January 27th, he's hosting, Bobby Bottle Service is hosting a nightclub, the nightclub Moon in the Palms Casino.
All right. No, you go first.
I really hope comedy nerds come out to Moon to come and see you.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be so fucking weird.
Yeah. And then the next day, if you're a comedy nerd and you live in Vegas and you don't want to go to a nightclub, Bobby might be making an actual meet and greet appearance.
Now, here's a question that I have for you. It's sort of the Belushi conundrum, right? So what if, you know, would you want to be super successful if you were embraced by not the comedy nerds that you enjoy, but by people who didn't get the actual joke of what you're doing, where they're just like,
is that how
Bobby Bottle Service is fucking... Yeah, like after he played Bluto,
that was
and everyone was like, oh my God, you fucking... Yeah. That fucking guy.
Aziz has trouble with that with Randy.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he does.
Yeah. You know, I think like... I think as long as you do... And I mean, Chappelle like ran into it with... You know, by the way, like... I should be so lucky to have fans that I don't like. do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. And I'm aware of that. I think it's like, and it's been interesting with like the league where I think it's attracted non-comedy fans to you know, like who just like, you know, fantasy football and like the show. And if, in my feeling is like, if they, you know, like my stuff on the show and then that draws them to listen to my other stuff, then great. I think it's like, I think the problem for all of us is like when, if you build a larger fan base and then you begin to change your material to keep them happy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, and you're no longer doing stuff that you think is funny. I think as long as you're doing things that are you think are funny, then either those people will continue to like you or they won't. And generally the people who like Bobby Bottles, I mean, it's amazing. There are times where I've gotten fans, people who are like, I love Bobby B, and I like go to their page and it's like, they're basically Bobby B. You know what I mean? Yeah, they're, but I think, but I'm like, but if they get it and they enjoy it, then like, great, you know? I'm not going to fight him on it.
I think you should fight him on it.
Yeah,
I think Bobby Bottle Service would fight him on it.
Yeah. I know what you're saying, and I, you know, it's like, I think it's like if people get it, great, and if they don't, then what are you going to do?
Nick and I did the Benson Interruption together, and the previous year we had done John Oliver's show together. And I think this year for the Benson Interruption, when you came in and you high five and you're like, here's to another year of Comedy Central stand-up show that's not ours. Or it was like, something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah. Like, they're in the stable of good enough to be on the show.
Not good
they're
enough
not,
to have
They're not own. Getting their own. Welcome to the stage, Chris Hardwick and Nick Kroll.
Those were fun, though. The Oliver show was a blast.
Yeah.
And
great crowd.
They're doing a second season. They just did a second season.
Yeah, with a lot of good people on it.
Amazing. Incredible people.
Yeah, and
incredible-maze-balls.
Yeah,
it
was really fun, and that crowd, that New York crowd, was great at the Skirball. I think. I wonder if they're doing it there again.
I think they are actually.
Yeah,
yeah, they are.
It was super fun, and he's a very sweet dude. Like
wonderful guy.
A wonderful guy.
Did you have fun doing the Benson Interruption? I guess if you didn't, you probably wouldn't say no.
I did not have fun doing it. No, I did. I was freaked out because I was getting ready to do my special, like within two or three weeks after that. And so, you know, when you build these sets, you can't, especially when it's on one network, you can't have crossover material. So I'm building my hour, 45 minutes or whatever it is that's going to be for my special. And then on top of that, they're like, okay, so now build another 10 or 15 minutes of material to do on Benson.
That you don't want to burn through your stuff.
And I don't want to burn through the stuff that I've been working on for my special. So all of a sudden I'm like, so I have to go now spend a bunch of sets trying to work out what I'm going to do on the Benson thing. And so that was really stressful. But they, you know, it ended up being super fun, and I don't think I burned too much material. I did a version of the joke or the story about my first time doing stand up and one other thing. And you know, it ends up being such a short set. And with Doug interrupting, you don't end up burning that much material.
Yeah.
And it was super fun. I mean, you know, it's like, it was a fun night.
You know, I think I might have told you this. But when I was at UCLA in the UCLA Comedy Club, which was it was not an exciting name.
Shoot off of the chess club.
It kind of was, actually. It was a bunch of comedy nerds, and we'd get together once a week and help each other write material. But in one of the shows, there was a young comic who was a genuinely funny guy named Ryan, and he did a version of the pee his pants thing, except he did it for real.
Really?
So his whole thing was, he was going to go on stage and literally piss his pants during his set. And so backstage, he was just chugging all this like water and beer and trying to get all psyched up for it. And then when he went out on stage and then, you know, he did his thing like, oh, I think I'm kind of nervous. And he started peeing. I think the problem was he couldn't stop.
Yeah, you can't stop peeing once you start.
Yeah, especially if you've tried to front load
it. It's like when you're peeing and then you're like, "Oh, I got to take a dump." Like, how am I going to transition this? Do I have to finish peeing before I can turn around?
You just have to be really fast.
Right.
I think you just drop it right there, like just animal style. But we're just animals, right, dudes? We're just animals. Let's just live like animals. You know, I'm gonna eat raw food, shit wherever.
Right, but the problem is like it just ends up in your pant, like you just drop it straight into your pants.
I'm gonna start a new movement where you can just shit wherever you want called shit ebbs, which just means like
wait, so I just have a question.
Sure.
When you pee,
yeah.
I'm trying to think about what I do. Do you just let your pants drop to the ground? Do you hold them up? When you go to pee in the bathroom.
Yeah.
You go for a wide enough stance of it.
Do you widen out so that the pants like a black dude?
Yeah.
I think
you know, like black dudes like wear pants so low that they have to walk like cowboys.
To keep them up. Yeah. They constantly have to keep like flipping it back up.
Yeah,
on
exactly.
Their crotches when they perform.
Yeah, exactly. These are all observations I've made about them.
That's why the Tea Party really blah 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 and blah,
guys,
blah blah blah.
Do you guys
blah,
unbutton the top button? Then you go all the way open.
Yeah, I don't enjoy using the flap.
You don't enjoy just going out the flap?
No.
Yeah. Don't trust it.
I don't drop my pants like a 4-year-old.
No, or Bernie Brillstein. That's what he would do.
What?
Fucking
take them off.
He would just like he would be in a public bathroom, a urinal, and he would just like underwear and everything, drop his pants to the ground and just pee.
You know that dates back to something that happened as a child.
Yeah,
like you stand there and you pee until you do it right, yeah. And then it just like
yeah. I was talking to Neil Mahoney, and he was saying he's like, yeah, I always thought it was just like a thing everyone kind of made fun of him for that didn't really happen. And then he went once into a bathroom at a shoot, and it was just Bernie Brillstein at a urinal, pants on the ground.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, because I was thinking about that, like the idea pants of your pants ground, being on pants the, on the ground. Being you're having your pants on like a bathroom floor is so gross.
Yeah. I don't even like having the bottoms of my shoes on bathroom floors, much less having to put clothing on that's going to touch it again.
Yeah, I really connected with that with this one moment from Seinfeld where he was like throwing away a belt and Elaine was like, "What happened?" He's all, "Oh, when I was in a public bathroom, the buckle banged against the wall." And she's all, "So that's the end of that?" She's like, "That's the end of that."
Yeah, we did a bit on the league this year that Jeff Schaefer came up with called like a bathroom cubby. He's like, once you bring a drink into a bathroom, like it's infected with bathroom.
Of course.
Or like even chewing gum, because you're like chewing whatever you smelled in the bathroom. Yeah, it's in the air, and then you're like re-chewing it. So he was like, they should have bathroom cubbies. And we did on the show where it's like you have a cubby outside of the bathroom where you put your drinks or you put like your iPad or whatever it is so that it doesn't get infected with bathroom.
What's up with the iPad? Why was made to take it to the bathroom.
I refer to the iPad as the bathroom activity center.
Well, I think that's like your home at like are you oftentimes in public bathrooms being like, I gotta take a fucking screamer. I'm gonna go in there for like 20, 25.
Go play Infinity Blade. Yeah, sometimes. I mean, when I do really take a screamer.
Yeah.
I will. Did you ever audition for SNL?
I did. Two years ago.
What was that process like?
That was... Mulaney and I were pitching a movie out here for Tracy Morgan, to write for Tracy Morgan. And we got a call being like, they want you to come in and test. And we were with him, so we got to talk to him about it, which was amazing. Because like Tracy Morgan, we were in between going from producer to pitch it, and we're sitting in his manager's office. He's taking like an afternoon, like not a nap, but just like a little downtime with Tracy Morgan. And he's just like, "Lorne Michaels is my dude," you know. And then he eventually goes, he's like half asleep, just goes like, "I will not lead a life of quiet desperation." And he talked about how hard it was at first, but how much he ended up loving. And it was actually pretty cool to be like, we're about to embark on this thing, and to be with a guy who'd been on the show and then had, you know, achieved all this success. And then we both went to New York and And I was, yeah, I tested for it, and I felt, like, pretty good about it. So I'm backstage, and there's, like, 25 people, you know, and they bring you down in threes.
And you're actually testing in Studio 8H, right?
Unfortunately, it was during the Olympics, so we tested on the Conan stage at NBC at the time, okay. I really wanted to walk out.
You're going to say, unfortunately, it was during the Olympics, so we had tested in Athens.
Yeah. It was during a bus strike. So I get there, and you come down in threes. It was me, Liz Kakowski, and it wasn't Jordan Peele. I'm trying to remember who the third was. Our little trio of people, and they bring you down in threes, and you wait backstage, and then like so I'm backstage. I'm about to go out, and the guy backstage goes like the grip, just like a grip backstage goes like. He's like, you know, you look like, who did he say? I can't remember now. But he said, like, you know, you look like, people ever tell you look like Goldblum, Jeff Goldblum? And I said, and I made some joke to him about it.
Yeah.
And he was like, save it for the stage. And I was just like, wait, you just made me,
you
like,
you opened the door.
Yeah. So then they're like, the stage manager's like, all right, so I'll call you out. You walk out on stage, you'll say hello, and then go right into it. Like, don't chat with him, blah, 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 blah. So he brings me out. I go out there, and the setup, I mean, it depends on, the year, but oftentimes it's like Lorne Michaels, Marcy Klein, who is, like, you know, one of his senior executive producers, and then now I know probably – now in knowing more about the show is, like, Steve Higgins, Mike Shoemaker, two of the senior producers, and then a bunch of the other writers who are there to just sort of watch. And, you know, there's like a cadre of probably like four people at a table and then another 10 or 12 people you can't really see sort of in the back. Seth Meyers, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I walk out there and it's just Lauren at the table. And I go out and I'm like, hello. And he's like, people are in the bathroom. And I'm like, people were freaking out that I was coming out, and he was like, excuse me?
Oh,
and I'm like,
shit.
It's just people were super excited that I was coming out, so they had to go to the bathroom. And he's like, ha ha ha. No. So I then had to go. So then the stage manager's like, I'm so sorry, come back. So then I had to go backstage. They basically iced me for 5 minutes. I don't blame. I mean,
I think it was a conspiracy with the grip. sounds like there was all something going on. There was a bigger picture.
Lorne, he didn't save it for the stage. He was using it in the back.
All right, everyone take a bathroom break.
Yeah, so I waited for like 5 minutes backstage and then came back out and did it. And I felt like, you know, it was good. You know, I think like it wasn't, you know, I didn't. And blow it, but I also at that particular time was like, you know, they didn't need me, and they don't particularly need me now. Like they had their cadre of like 30-year-old white guys, mm-hmm. you know, and especially as soon as Sandberg, I mean, I always wanted to be on a snow, but as soon as Sandberg got, I was like, how many bespectacled big lip Jews are they going to have on the show?
You can never have too many, in my opinion.
Yeah, I was like, do you want the guy who's going to get you like 50 million hits with his like raps, or the guy who's going to get you like 10,000 with his Upper West Side middle-aged divorced Jew who's obsessed with Alan Alda character? Who do you think you want? But then Mulaney got a job writing there out of that because he auditioned as well.
And does he do a lot of characters, or how did he audition?
Mulaney's capable of doing all of it. But his audition was stand up that had character stuff involved, and he was interested in performing and or writing. And I was sort of like, I just want to, my ego won't allow me to be backstage. So but it, you know, it's like I really believe like in all of it. And maybe it's because I've been like blessed enough to have success, but like it all happens for a reason, for whatever reason it happens. You know what I mean? Like it would have been amazing to be on SNL, but I wouldn't have done whatever I've done in the last 3 years if I had been there.
So you're saying you think Jesus Christ has a plan for you?
I feel like Jesus Christ has a plan because I'm represented by Jesus. he's my manager. and he's been great.
Oh, you're JCE, Jesus Christ Entertainment.
Yeah. Did you ever audition for SNL?
No, I never. I never auditioned for SNL. I auditioned for Mad TV a bunch. You know, they're based out here. Well, maybe not a bunch, but maybe like two or three years, like in the 90s. And
when it meant something.
Yeah, back when the show was. Well, anyway, so but that process was maddening. Not to, I didn't mean it that way. I didn't mean it that way. That process would drive you insane because you go in and it's those were small rooms.
By the way, Caliendo has trademarked maddening.
Did he really? It's his now. It's his.
Those were small rooms.
They were very small rooms, and it was just like a handful of people, and you'd go in, and then they'd be like, "All right, go." You just do your goddamn characters, but then but you can hear everyone because you're sitting in the waiting room. You can hear everyone do their characters, and you know. And I'm sure that my characters to them sounded just as awful as their characters sounded to me. Yeah. Where you're just sitting there and like really loud sports guy,
yeah,
character, you know, like maddening. Oh, another Chicago lady, another Chicago lady,
yeah.
But my characters weren't any better, you know. But just at the time, I was arrogant about that. So
clearly, you didn't get the job.
I did not.
But there is something about just auditioning for anything where you can hear the other people's auditions, and it's like that's the worst feeling.
And you got to walk back out and look at other people as it's the worst thing that can happen to a person. I said it, okay? It is absolutely the worst problem a person can have.
Haiti, Iraq.
All of it, the same thing.
Try an audition in this town.
Yeah.
First world problems. So what's next after the special? You've now purged yourself of all this material. You're going to go on the road?
No.
Well, I don't know. Lee got picked up for a third season.
Yeah. So I'll be working on that and probably in June. And then I'm working on something else hopefully before that. So we'll see what happens with it. But, you know, I it's time to build a new set, which is frightening. But also exciting. I think we'll see what it is. But it is weird to like you work and work and work and you build one set and you do it and then you're like, okay. And then I've been talking to different people being like, yeah, you can keep doing some of that material. Some people want to hear that material versus like Louis or, you know, now like Aziz being like, I want to do a new hour like every year or whatever. And like, I'm just like, how do you do that? Now I think with like Louis, he's a guy who's been doing it forever and is a genius. And not everybody has to do it like that.
His brain is sort of a machine. You can just kind of chuck any topic into it and it'll come out. Louis.
Right.
Him and I think Paul F. Tompkins the same way.
Paul F. Tompkins wrote the fucking funniest, one of the funniest things I've ever read about this, a recap of the most recent American Idol.
I haven't read it yet. I've heard it's super.
New York Magazine?
Yeah.
Phenomenal. I tweeted a link on my, if you go to @Nerdist, it's on my tweet stream, the link to it, or you can go on to Paul's, P.F. Yeah. Tompkins, but it is. Literally, he keeps referring to Steven Tyler like Steven Tyler has died, and at one point he refers to Steven Tyler as a living candle.
That's right. Oh, that's really funny. That's really funny.
It's a fucking phenomenal piece.
Yeah.
It's like so much of it. So much of it is and it's a sign of a great comic because when you're reading it, you can actually hear Paul's voice in your head.
That's the thing is like, you know, Paul and Louis, they're guys whose voices are so clear that they have such a clear point of view on the world that to build new material is easy for them. Well, it's not easy for them, but I think it's like it's just like they know where they're coming from.
Yeah, they go through the filter that is them. And that
My print writing I cannot translate it into stand up. Like it just they're just separate. Separate. Print writing is very wordy, and my stand up is different. But to see someone like if Paul had performed that,
he could have done it.
He could have done it on stage.
Yeah. Well, that's been interesting. Like I started a Bobby B Twitter account. Which, you know, if you have to see it, it's @aka Bobby B.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. The one of your first tweets, I think, was hilarious. It was the favorite actor?
Yeah, my favorite Bobby's favorite actor is Vinny Chase. And today was like heroes. Like his heroes are like Donald Trump. What was it? Donald Trump. Giuliani, parentheses, never forget. All UFC fighters. And the guy who came up with vodka. But it's fun to write in his voice, almost easier than it is to write, like, yeah, like Twitter for, is a, another anxiety-ridden place for me where I'm like, oh, I got to come up with a new, you know, like, how, what do I think about this?
Now, I'm surprised that comedy, that MTV or someone hasn't set up a thing where you go, you know, like panel the Jersey Shore people as Bobby Bottle Service.
They've tried.
Oh, they have?
Sort of. I did a spoofed thing, like they had a show about all the spoofs that had popped up around Jersey Shore,
yeah.
And Bobby informally hosted it. Like, I didn't deal with them directly. Because I feel like with them, like, once they're in on the joke, it's not as funny.
Yeah.
No, they couldn't be in on the joke.
Yeah.
But I guess they probably would be. They'd have to.
That's the problem. But I think, you know, we'll see where it all goes.
Because if you're doing comedy near them, you don't want them doing comedy too.
Yeah, because that just sort of takes away from it. To me.
And I'm pretty sure they're not sketch performers. Did Snooki audition for SNL?
Probably. Snooki, not. Yeah. Snooki.
Okay, you could stop doing that character.
Yeah. What are you talking about? Yeah, it was kind of like when Palin was on SNL with Tina Fey as Palin. Like, I felt that deflated the entire thing. Like,
yeah.
That wasn't like a pinnacle. I think of the bit. I think that's kind of. I didn't like it. I didn't want her being in on the joke.
Yeah, you don't want them to be friends with her.
Yeah, and you just don't. Yeah, you don't want them to benefit from. You know, I don't know. But they're. I mean, you know, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating little world that they've created. Is that an empty statement to make?
No, I know. I know. It's not at all. The fact that. I mean, I guess I'm trying to think back. I always look at pop culture now and go, oh, I'm so angry at all the shit you're making, pop culture. But then I think back to when I was a teenager, and I consume some pretty shitty stuff.
Yeah.
So I just try to imagine, like, yeah, this stuff, you know, it's not for me. And, you know, the stuff that I like is a little more obscure, but that makes it, you know, special to me. And I don't know. So maybe I just have
to. Yeah, you have to have a general thing for you to react against with your taste to make your taste seem cooler.
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
Mm.
Any like that?
I just got bent.
I do actually have to go right now.
So, you know, what I wanted to find out is when you were growing up.
Yeah.
Could you just tell a really long story about how school was?
No, I'm sorry. I'm Bobby. It has to make an appearance for a meet and greet right now.
You know, now that you say that, I've never seen you and Bobby in the same room at the same time.
I know. There is a promo, by the way, for the stand-up special with Fabrice and me together. They shot like a composite thing, nice. Which is super weird
Don't
to have them.
Don't give away the magic, Nick.
Wait, you're? Fucking ruined it.
Oh my.
Spoiler alert.
Well, we were talking about this beforehand. Like, some people are like, no, my characters are separate from me and like they live. And I would love that, but I am too. I want the credit too much. Yeah, I want the credit too much for.
I want all the people in high school that put stuff me in trash cans to know that I did something.
Yeah, that I'm. That I'm. Yeah, that I play a bizarrely vicious gay Latin craft services coordinator. That's me. That's in my heart and mind.
Well, we'll let you go. So, but your special. Thank you. Very cool. Premieres on Comedy Central.
Thank you. Very cool with Tupac.
Premieres January 29th on Comedy Central at 10
p.m.
10 p.m. Yes. On Comedy Central. That's probably Eastern time. So,
and thank you for
Nick Kroll. Thank you for being here on the Nerdist Podcast.
Thank you guys for having me. It's very fun.
I hope you enjoy your burrito.
I do.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.